Oh, hello, Kantians. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm very excited for you guys to hear this interview that Cabe and I put on with our guest. He is pretty established in the country music scene and the industry, and has worked with big-time artists like Lady Antebellum. He currently works with Martina McBride, Riley Green, Cassidy Pope, Lane Hardy, and Jeffrey James. So I hope you guys really take to heart what our guest has to share as far as insights go, and just cool stories to get you motivated or just to shed some light on things you never knew about in the music industry. So I'd like to introduce the great and powerful Daniel Miller. I hope you guys enjoy.
Coors Banquet, brewed in the Rockies.
And we are live. Welcome, welcome.
Hey guys, what's up?
Welcome back to the Icon TV podcast with Lakota and Cabe. And today we have a really cool guest that Cabe is introducing me to. And I'm really excited for this. So Cabe, do you want to introduce your guest?
Yeah, you don't know him, so I'm going to introduce him.
Please do.
That was sarcasm. Our guest today is my sensei. He's kind of my mentor, I guess. I don't know. He might not say that, but had him. He was my professor in the spring. And luckily he still texts me back when I ask him random questions about the music business. So everybody, please give a warm welcome to the legendary artist manager, Daniel Miller. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, guys. That was a pretty impressive introduction, actually.
Yeah, that was the fly, honestly. That was on the fly.
That was the best introduction I've heard on this podcast.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
Thank you, guys.
That's awesome. So Daniel, one thing that since Cabe has joined me as my full-time co-host, what we try and do is just start the podcast off with a game.
Oh wow!
It's a fun game. It's called Stuff Happens. Have you ever heard of it?
I've not, but I'm looking forward to it.
So good, because it's really fun.
It's actually super fun, Daniel.
So basically how it works, and I'll keep reminding the listeners until they get the point, this is not how you originally play this game, but Cabe and I have adapted it for doing these remote podcasts. So basically the cards here are miserable things that could happen in someone's life, and they are indexed on a misery index from 1 to 100, but 1 being like not too bad, 100 being the worst. And so each person, and I'm just going to pin you and Cabe against each other. So I'm just going to be the game show host for this one.
Hell yeah. A little competition. Even better.
So basically, I'm going to pull two cards, and we'll start with you, Daniel. And I'm going to read them off to you, and you have to decide what you think is the worst. Mm. And there's a misery index that was made by behavioral psychologists, therapists, all sorts of, you know, people who study mental health and anguish. Damn. And that's how they came up with this. So you kind of have to think objectively about these. So let me mix up these cards. Probably should have done that beforehand, but it'll take me just a quick second. Any questions on how to play?
No, just this is my own scale of misery or just humans in general?
So it's going to be just humans in general.
Got it.
So when I read the first two cards, you'll get the gist of it. It's pretty self-explanatory how we play it.
Kind of like Cards Against Humanity, right? Sort of the same deal. A
little bit.
Yeah, actually, some of the examples probably were derived straight out of Cards Against Humanity, which is a game that we should play sometime. I just don't know how we would play. We'd have to incorporate.
There's an app for it. That would be so much fun if we played that damn game on a podcast, dude. I love that game.
We will. We'll make that one like a marathon one. Okay. Daniel, I'm going to draw two cards. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So your first one is you fall down a hill.
Okay.
And your second one is your identity is stolen.
Ooh. Okay. I need to rate each one of those?
You don't have to rate them. You just have to pick which one do you think is highest on the misery index.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Identity being stolen for sure.
Yeah. Easy. That's so easy.
Yeah. That one wasn't easy. So the index for falling down a hill is only 18.1.
Dude, that's so low.
I know, but I think it depends on the hill, right? Because yeah. If it's like a little like, you know, meadow with grass and stuff like that, that hill's not too bad. But if you're falling off of like Mount McKinley, that's pretty bad.
That's different.
It's different. It's different. And identity stolen is 66.5, which yeah. I think would be much higher than that. Because if my identity was stolen, they're not getting away with much, but still, it's just annoying.
It'd be better. So that's how you. It'd be better if the question was if you could push somebody down the hill. That would be a whole different scale.
That's the fun index.
Yeah.
Right. That's awesome. So you won that round. So we're gonna do best out of
three.
Let's say best three out of three. Let's do three. All right. And if there's no way to tie that. So Cabe, you're next.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so your first card is find a half a worm and an apple you're eating. And your second card is you're added to the no-fly list.
No-fly list.
Barely.
Really? Yeah.
Barely.
Can I give you a story about the no-fly list while we're playing the game?
Can you what?
Can I give you a story about no-fly list in the middle of the game?
Yes.
Please do. So that's the whole point of this is like kind of juice up the brain a little bit. Yeah, please do.
So a few years ago when I was flying to Toronto, I was checking in at the airport in Nashville. And
Rest in peace, B&A carpet.
Yeah. The gate attendant was typing away in her computer. And all of a sudden she stopped typing and her eyes got really big. And she's like, I'll be right back. I'm in a hurry. I'm always late for my flight as is. And so she walks off and she brings somebody back and like pointing on her screen, all this stuff. And the guy that comes over with her, his eyes get really big. And they said, sir, can you step aside for a moment? And I thought, what in the hell? So we go over, they start asking all these crazy questions. Well, so then it finally gets all cleared and everything. When I land in Toronto and I get through immigration, the immigration attendant calls the security guy over and they start having a really similar conversation. And it's like, I don't know what is wrong with me today, but nobody wants me to go into Canada. So they have a conversation, ask me a bunch of questions, and they sort of begrudgingly let me go on through customs. Well, then I go to get my baggage and the security guy there has a hold of my suitcase. They said, Mr. Miller, we got to scan your suitcase again. I was like, look, what the fuck is going on? So I never did figure it out until the next time I flew to Toronto. It started happening again. And I told the gate agent the same story. She's like, well, when she figured it out, she's like, there is a Daniel Miller on the do not fly list in Canada. I don't know what he did, but it was really bad. So every time I've gone since, I go through this like triple screening process.
Oh, that sucks.
That's ridiculous.
I got into like tried to kill the Prime Minister of Canada or something.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would just road trip from now on.
Yeah.
If that was the case.
Or eat a worm out of my apple.
Yeah. No. I'll never do that.
Don't you wish you had chosen the worm now instead of the do not fly list?
No, because then we got this amazing story on why you're a terrorist in Canada.
So why were they, what were the rankings?
So the rankings for the no-fly list was 65.5 and the worm and the apple was 50.1, which I think is way too high.
Dude.
Yeah. I feel like, I mean, yeah, like it's mortifying, that shock factor, like, oh, but it's just more protein and apples don't have any protein in them. So I don't think that's too bad. So, all right, you guys are tied right now. We might have to do an extra round. So, Daniel, it's your turn. Okay, your first card is your hand is super glued to your face. I feel like we done this one before?
We had the apple one, I think, too, but do it again. I don't remember this one.
I feel like maybe I was just like looking at these on my spare time. You know, I don't have a life. So
they're all new to me, so.
Okay, good. Yeah. Perfect. So your hand is super glued to your face. And then your second card is your paycheck is lost.
I'm going with paycheck for sure.
Barely. That one was really close too. So the super glued to your face is only 51.3. I feel like that one would be a little bit higher.
I would feel like that's definitely higher. Your hand super glued to your damn face.
Yeah, God, yeah. Could you imagine trying to peel that away?
I mean, it could be super glued to worse parts of your body.
Facts.
Very, very true.
Very true.
Very, very true. That reminds me of, I don't know if you guys have ever watched Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Okay, when Howard gets he's using the robot from the space lab. It gets stuck around his junk.
Oh, yeah.
He has to take it to the emergency room. That's so funny. And then Paycheck is Lost was 57.1.
Wow.
Which,
Those people must not need their paycheck too badly.
I know, right? I feel like that would be devastating for me. It's like, okay, well.
A pandemic would change the ranking of these cards, I feel like. A little bit.
Very true. Very true. Anything financial related would be like 100 easily. Yeah. Okay. So, Daniel's up. So, Cabe, we're going to go for another round.
Okay.
And then we'll move on from this.
Why don't we do for the last round, we both get the same card. Now, because never mind. Then we might both pick the same thing. Never mind. Bad idea.
Yeah, you might. We could do that as a tiebreaker if it's tied. Okay. So, Cabe, your first one is you're thrown from a merry-go-round.
Yeah.
Did you need me to repeat that one?
No, I heard you.
Okay. And then the second one is you lose your front teeth.
Ooh.
God.
This one's a
Well, you would lose your front teeth falling from the merry-go-round, but I do think losing your front teeth would probably be worse. Maybe.
Okay.
No. Yeah, actually, I'm going front teeth. Yeah.
Okay. So, Daniel, what were you going to say?
Final answer?
Final answer, front teeth.
So, no, it was the merry-go-round.
Whatever. No.
Yeah, I think the lose the front teeth would be higher too. But that's why you have to you kind of have to look at these semi-objectively, I guess. Yeah,
because you could also replace your teeth.
Yeah.
You could replace your teeth, but I don't know. I mean, I guess broken bones heal.
You could probably die from getting thrown from a merry-go-round. That's true. Depending on how fast it's going, you know. What's funny is that they have these little pictures on the cards. And for the listeners, I'll post them on the Instagram, I Can't Even Podcast. But for the lose the front teeth, it has a corn cob. I guess that's super common. I don't know, with eating corn. So congratulations, Daniel. You won.
Shout out, Daniel.
Yeah, so,
Victor.
So again, for the listeners, this is not how you play the game, but I feel like it's just a fun way to kind of wake up the brain a little bit and
break the ice a tad.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right, Daniel. So let's jump right into it. There's first thing I want to ask you about. One, we'll figure out a way to post this to the Instagram, get the link out or something. But the interview with Billboard published on August 18th. So before we talk about what was in the in the interview, how did that even happen? Does Billboard just call you and say, hey, or what happens?
Yeah, I've done a couple interviews with them. So the one you're talking about ran in the Billboard Country Weekly. It comes out every Monday night specifically to the country music geared toward radio, but to the industry overall. Tom Rowland, who's the editor and writes that feature every week, just reached out and said, hey, we have a feeling that managers are really kind of feeling the crunch during COVID-19, but it seems like your roster is thriving. And it's I'm just sort of curious how you've done that and what you've experienced. So the article doesn't go very deep or as deep as our conversation did anyway. But I just said, look, since we shut down in March, we've put out at least 25 different songs, most of which have videos with them. We've got two or three virtual series out there. We've released two albums. We got two more coming this year, and just a lot of things. So the point of my response to him really was, we haven't stopped. We haven't slowed down. We didn't miss a beat. Our whole team is still intact at the moment. And we're really just looking at 2020 as a year of reinvestment and reinvention and fun, trying to find ways to do things more efficiently.
Oh yeah.
That's awesome. And I feel like right now for musicians and vocal artists or writers for that matter, this is a really good time to kind of like den up and dive into your work because there's nothing else to distract you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So. I mean, it's, you know, I also, I don't know if it was in the story or not, but I also said, you know, we always plan for the best and worst case scenarios every year. And we hope to exceed our best case scenario. In this one, we exceeded our worst case scenario.
By a lot.
But we were prepared for this, you know, financially and just psychologically to some extent. And thankfully, we adjusted really quickly. I mean, I was in New Orleans, what I sort of call D-Day, March 9th or something, I believe it was.
The day it really shit hit the fan, the day that I was with you at the show. Because you were like, hey, Stagecoach canceled. Like that was, and then the next day, which was a Tuesday, was when like I was getting reports like, hey, like we might not have school. Belmont just canceled the rest of the semester. Like,
yeah.
Oh shit. This is like serious.
Yeah. Started going down really fast. And
it was like a period of 3 days that it was like the whole world was just completely like streets empty. It was crazy.
Yeah. The worst of that for us was I was in New Orleans. Lane Hardy had a music video shoot, and I had Martina McBride in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, I think, and Riley Green in Madison, Wisconsin on the Jason Aldean tour. Mm-hmm. And all of these things were like shifting and changing in real time, and I'm stuck at a hotel in New Orleans. I never left the hotel. I landed in New Orleans, went to the hotel, spent all day changing things around, and went back to the hotel and flew home. And it reminded me a lot, and it's hard to compare these two things, but in terms of like affecting our day the most, it seemed as similar to 9/11 as anything else in my career had.
That's crazy.
So dive into that a little bit more. How is that similar to 9/11?
Yeah. So for me in the company that I worked for at the time when 9/11 happened, I mean, I was in my apartment. I'd only been out of school for a year and a half, and was watching the planes crash into the Twin Towers, and went ahead and drove to work. And as I was driving to work, all you could see in the sky were airplanes headed toward the Nashville airport. It was like a science fiction movie. How many planes were in the air at the same time, sort of circling the airport. But then the rest of the day was really spent canceling shows and cancel like everything we had going on had to just cancel really fast. And then it just sort of went quiet for a while. And, you know, everybody was really scared what to do. We didn't know what was going to happen in the whole world. And we just kind of sat in the office watching the TV all day. The similarity here was, you know, all the shows came to a screeching halt. We had to get people home however we could, but we also didn't really know in the moment how bad this was or how bad it was going to be. And you're trying to like calm the artist's fears of what's going on, not only in the moment, but their future. And, you know, at the time I really felt like, okay, we're going to move these shows and in 2, maybe 4 weeks max, it'll all be back and won't be that big of a deal. We never could have dreamed that what has happened would have happened.
Yeah. Especially like 5 months in, going on 6 months.
Yeah.
Of cities just being completely shut down.
Yeah.
So as far as like those shows go, are you still like hopeful that, okay, here in the next month or 2 months, we can start rolling? Do you guys have shows that are like social distance going on right now? Or how are you adapting now going on 6 months in?
Yeah. So that's one thing that the article picked up on that I said. So our revenue is almost entirely based on live events. And we will lose 95% of our projected income this year. So almost all of our shows either postponed or canceled. I think we have 2 more left in the year between all of our artists together. And as of right now, we sort of pick back up mostly in April. Some people are saying that it may be June until shows really pick up, but it depends what level you're talking about. But on the positive side of that, you asked about social distance shows. we are putting together a concept now with a really, really smart promoter we love working with, where we'll try to take over some outdoor venues. You know, the outdoor open air shows we feel like are the safest, and really inspired by a photo or a meme or whatever it was of a festival over in the UK a couple of weeks ago, where they had little pods of bike racks set up on this outdoor event space.
Did you see that, Lakota?
I didn't, but I've seen like Bert Kreischer's, like the drive-ins that he's doing.
It's similar to that. It was like a festival. Okay. I'll find the picture really quick.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, we're going to sort of mimic that and look at colleges, probably, you know, SEC colleges or, you know, at least in the Southeast, that have small baseball fields or football fields that we can just go and be able to set up these little pods of small groups and set up shows that way. You know, I'm not a really big fan of the drive-in shows. We can't scale them economically to make them work very well, but we do feel like there's a way we can do this with just small pods of people.
Daniel, I probably asked you about this, but what did you think about the John Party, Brad Paisley, Darius Rucker, like parking lot show? Like just overall.
I mean, I didn't go. I talked to some people that did. They thought it was fantastic. You know, even though you're really far back in a lot of cases and you can't see, and I don't know this for sure, but what I've sort of heard through the grapevine is just economically, it didn't work at all. You can't scale it with the cars to get enough people in that space to cover, you know, the cost and everything.
I got you.
You just sent me the picture. Sorry, Gabe.
No, you're good.
That's brilliant. I mean, honestly, that's a really safe way to do to adjust to what's happening right now, where you're not contributing to numbers rising. You're not getting in trouble with any kind of, you know, authorities, any states. I mean, this is what restaurants are doing in Texas.
Yeah.
Right now, where like my wife and I went to Chili's today. I mean, it was completely empty. There was nobody in Chili's. Granted, they had just opened. It was like 11. And we're like, we're hungry. But they had like every other table closed off.
It's so like that at like, school.
You really had to be spread out.
It's like that at school too. Daniel, you know, in the Bragg 101, like the big, like 65, 70 person classroom, right?
Yeah.
So they have that every other row. There's like two seats. It's so weird to be in the classroom. I was in it today and our class only has 15 people of it. And there were four of us in the class.
Wow.
It was bizarre.
Well, talking about classrooms, my father-in-law is a teacher. He's a middle school teacher down here in Laredo, Texas. And they have the staff on a rotating 3-week schedule. So 3 weeks they work from home, teaching from home on Zoom, and then 3 weeks in the classroom just in case kids want to show up.
Yeah.
The very first day that school started, I think this was last Monday, they only had 4 students show up out of I think it was a capacity of 700 students that were enrolled for the year. 4 students showed up.
That's insane. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Things are changing. It's weird.
It's bizarre, man. It really is. It's weird when you hit Daniel, you know this. You go down. I mean, you see downtown probably. I don't know where you live, but I mean, when you drive down Broadway right now and there's no one on Broadway and like there's no music, it's a weird feeling.
Yeah, it feels like the apocalypse, you know.
It's exactly what it feels like. It's like feels like it's out of a movie.
You know, the weird thing, though, as we start exploring these options and talking to people, I feel like there are a lot of really logical people who have lost all their sense, because we've even talked about scenarios on military bases where the personnel have been quarantined for several months. They've been tested regularly. There's 0% chance that the virus is on the base. And we said, let's come in and do a show. We'll make sure that our personnel are completely distanced from the attendees.
Where did you say this was?
We've just been exploring different military bases.
Oh, okay.
And so we've sort of figured, you know, got to a point where we figured out the logistics and how to keep everybody safe. And then I've said, well, great. The good thing is then you can just like cram all those guys and women together and let them have a really good time. And people are like, oh my God, no. You've got to socially distance them. I said, distance them from what? There's 0% chance of any infection. People are like, no, just for the optics, you got to keep people really spaced apart. And that just concerns me about Americans and their mentality about just logically thinking through things as we, you know, move forward and things get better.
Yeah.
That couldn't be like close to the truth. And I, even when everything started back in March, you saw people like raiding grocery stores, freaking out. We had the riots and stuff like that. And it's like that all contributed to higher numbers because people are not social distancing. They're not being smart about it, but then they're also attacking other people. You know, like when I go on my morning runs, I don't wear a mask. I'm not going to wear a mask. It's hard to breathe.
Yeah.
But I'll get nasty looks from like, you know, stay at home moms or, you know, people just like walking around the track.
And you're like at least 20 feet from people.
At least. Or yeah. if I'm passing them, they're wearing a mask. So kudos. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm spreading it to all the plants, I guess. Right. around the lake. I don't know what to tell you. Right. I'm not going to wear a mask, but it's a weird kind of like, we're already super divisive in this country, especially in the past decade. It's gotten really divisive.
I had no idea.
Oh, it's crazy, man. It's crazy. I'll send you some articles.
Great.
But COVID, I feel like even this far in, it's still like people are so emotionally attached to certain ideology, even in situations like that, where it's like logically clear that there is no way anybody can be infected.
Yeah.
Nobody can. Right. They haven't been in touch with the, you know, quote unquote outside world, you know, any civilian or anyone outside of the base.
Right. Well, and, you know, it creates a challenge for us because we've got to educate and get fans excited about coming back to shows again. And you have sort of all these false narratives and just irrational fears that could really take years for people to sort of figure out from.
Daniel, I'll go ahead and tell you, as a fan, I am so excited for shows to come back.
Yeah.
I was going to second that.
Oh my God.
I feel
like you don't realize how much you miss live music. I don't even go to like a ton of shows, and I don't know how many shows you go to, Daniel, other than your artist that you're with. But like, I mean, we're probably going to 3 or 4 shows a month in Murfreesboro alone, not to mention like a big tour at Bridgestone or going to the Riley show at the Floribama. Like, holy crap, man.
Yeah.
And people, I've heard people say that like the Instagram lives and like this stuff is going to be it for the future. And obviously I'm not shitting on anybody for doing that because they're trying to do their best right now. But that is not the move when things can get back to normal.
No.
Like the energy of a live show and the rumble of a crowd and you hear the freaking amps turn up at the beginning of the show, like nothing can beat that.
It can't be replicated.
It cannot be replicated whatsoever.
I think the closest thing, and I don't know if people have like explored this, but like VR, you know, in the time being is like putting on like a VR show. Cause those were getting pretty big. I remember last year they were doing VR for sports events where you could purchase a virtual ticket and it would be like you're sitting in the chair.
Yeah.
Right. Courtside and stuff like that. And I mean, no, it's not the same, right? Live shows, just like Cape said, there's an energy about it. That's like really exciting where you're seeing your
live sports.
Yeah. Where you're seeing your favorite artists or athletes or comedians or whoever in front of you, you know, share their craft with you, you know, songs that you love, sports that you love and stuff like that. But, you know, I think when everything does start opening back up, I don't think it's going to take long for fans to jump on that opportunity. I really don't. I'm just the same as like flights right now. Like I'm going to be traveling in and out of Alaska a lot here in the next few months. And I'm honestly very grateful for COVID right now because of that. Because tickets used to be like $700 out of Laredo or $1,000.
How much is it to fly to Anchorage now?
$153.
Oh my God. From Laredo to Anchorage, $153?
Uh-huh. And Laredo is really expensive to travel in and out of because there's 3 terminals. And they only have like a certain amount of flights. So they fly out to either Vegas or DFW.
Yeah, like a big airport. Dude, uh-huh. That's crazy.
Yeah. So there's, you know, obviously that's one perk out of like many cons that are going on right now. But, you know, I think once everything opens up, people are going to flock to it because they miss it. It's part of their identity. It's part of their lifestyle. It's part of their habits. Going to live shows or large venues. And I think it's mentally good for people. Yeah. It's not good for people to be cooped up like this.
No, it's not.
It's really not.
And also I think it just teaches all of us just the value of things. And it forces us just to recalibrate in a lot of ways, not only just music, but every area of business, and really figure out where your efficiencies are and where they can be. And, you know, what are you doing that doesn't make sense? And, you know, on the music side, when you are talking about, you know, there is no way to replicate the live experience. But what I'm hopeful happens after all this is it advances us more forward than we would have on our own. And we start to integrate more technology into the live experience just so that it's, you know, it's more modern. You know, I've been complaining for years that we have to go to one destination to buy tickets, another one to buy music, another one to buy merchandise, another one to buy something else. And you're sending fans in all these different places. And I've just said, we've got to figure out a way to let all this transaction happen in one place. And we haven't been able to do it yet, but I'm hoping that times like this push us forward toward that.
That's a really cool idea. So like if you're like checking out, just to kind of clarify, when you're checking out, let's say you want to see like Cassidy, what's her name?
Cassidy Pope.
Yeah. Let's say you're buying a ticket for a Pope concert. And while you're checking out, you could buy a Pope shirt. You can buy a hat. You can, that would be really cool.
You know, or you want to, maybe, you know, let's call it Amazon or a version of Amazon. You go to this one destination and you're buying a ticket, you're buying a digital album if you want to, or you're buying, you know, some version of that. And yeah, maybe you order a t-shirt and some other merchandise or item all in one transaction.
Yeah. And I've noticed that too. I don't know. I mean, I was looking at something last week. Daniel, you know, y'all know who NXS is, right?
Yeah.
So, Lakota, I think I've mentioned them on here, and you said you didn't know who they were, but like legendary rock band. Do you know them, Lakota?
I don't.
Okay. They're like an Australian rock band from the 80s and stuff. And they're still now, like, their lead singer's been, he's passed away like in 97 or something. And now they're doing like kind of revamping their old merch and like a package deal where you get like a vinyl of the 30 year anniversary of a record, and you get the vinyl and you get like a t-shirt and like some kind of merch thing. So I don't know, the package merch. Do you guys do that, Daniel? Like with your artists?
We call them D2C, so direct to consumer. So we try to always package an album or a digital download code with some kind of merchandise or collectible item.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's a couple of stories just came out where Billboard stopped letting us count those albums
towards album sales. I saw that,
and it's really ridiculous. I mean, we're going to do them anyway because it just, the fans have come to love them, and it's just a great value piece. But
yeah,
we try to do them every release.
So when I heard that, I heard Bobby say that on the Bobbycast. When I heard that, I thought, oh, like that makes logical sense. But from your perspective as management of a ton of like artists, why is that? Like, why is that a big deal? Like, why does it make sense to, or why does it not make sense to do that or to stop?
The only reason they're doing it is because there are a lot of artists that don't play by the rules. They're trying to game the system and just throw in ridiculous numbers for a chart position. And it just sort of kills it for the rest of us. But, you know, we're going to keep doing it anyway.
Good. I like seeing those.
So you got to give the fans what they want.
Yeah,
of course.
For sure. Yeah.
And again, that's why it's called direct to consumer. So we're not asking them to go to some third party platform. We're reaching out to our artists' most passionate and loyal fans directly, either through their email or text message or however we access them, and offer them something they can't get anywhere else.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Cabe and I can just knock on their door and sell it. We're trained in that.
Daniel, did you know I did door to door sales? Did I tell you that?
I did know that. And hopefully you've gotten out of it.
Yeah, I did. Don't come at us like that, dude. That's how we met.
Well, I want you to progress on to the next thing.
Yeah, well, give me an internship and we'll get there. All right.
I have a question for Daniel.
Okay.
So how do you even get into the position that you're in? Because
good question. You know, that's where I was going.
Yeah, I remember like watching Entourage and watching someone like Ari Gold, who is a talent manager in the show. If you're not familiar, please just go watch. Have you guys watched the show?
No.
It's amazing. Daniel, you said no?
No, I have. Yeah, it's great.
Oh, okay. And, you know, I look up at Ari Gold, who's just, you know, he's a tyrannical kind of manager. But it gave me a zest. Like, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be a talent manager. I'm going to go to law school like I was originally planning, and then I'm going to become a talent manager. Never did, because I really don't know how to do any of that. But what was your route? Like, start from, like, the first time it popped in your head, what you studied in school to become that, if you did, and you did, you said you'd been out of school for a year, and then like, how have you progressed to now running your own company?
Yeah.
Your own management firm.
So it's a little bit of a lengthy story, but I'll try to shorten it. So
we have time. Give us the goods, Daniel.
We have time.
Unless you have to be off, but
I'm good. So I originally started out in college as a finance major, because where I came from in a small town, Missouri, that was the only way people made a good living, is if you worked at a bank or in some sort of investment organization. But when I was there, and this was in the early 90s, country music was really hitting its boom. And I'd listen to music a lot as a younger person, but you know, where I grew up on a farm, Missouri, we didn't have a record player and our radio barely picked up a couple stations, so I didn't have a lot of access to music. But I was in college and was out at the nightclubs there, and country was just really, really hot at the time. So the main club that my friends and I went to, the guy that owned it managed a band named Ricochet, who had a kind of a hot moment in the early 90s. And I just sort of befriended him, and I'd never heard of an artist manager. I didn't even know there was a music business. I just knew that I liked music that I heard on the radio. And, you know, we didn't have internet then. We didn't have cell phones then. So researching that was nearly impossible. So all the information that I had came from this guy who I found out ended up sort of being more of a shyster than a good guy. But I just did as much research as I could. And honestly, I started taking CDs that I had in my apartment and going through the liner notes in the album packaging, and found two or three from different country artists I really liked. And I just started calling the companies. And it's so funny, because I probably wouldn't take that call today if somebody were calling me. So I'm glad somebody did. But I reached a couple different management offices and just said, hey, I'm just a kid in Missouri who really wants to come work in the industry, and I have no idea how to get started. And this one guy just took enough time and said, hey, you know, you got to be present to win. So you need to come here. You need to finish school. You need to volunteer every minute you have available, and you need to work your ass off harder than anybody else. And about 6 months later, I quit my job. I had a great banking job there. Quit my job, packed my shit, and moved to Nashville, enrolled in MTSU. And I didn't know anybody. I didn't know what I was doing. And just by pure coincidence, so I started at MTSU in August of 97. Back then, the CMA Awards were in September. And it just happened that a friend of mine worked in a guitar shop. It was on DeMumbrian at the time. And Sting was playing with Toby Keith that year on the show. And his guitar...
That is dope.
Well, I was thinking the same thing. That is so
sick,
cool.
Dude. That is a sick collab.
Well,
yeah.
It was amazing. I'm so happy I can't stop crying, I think was the name of the song. Anyway, his guitar tech had come in this guitar shop and was talking, and she helped him out get a guitar for the award show, whatever. And she had to work or had something going on the night of the show, and the guy had given her a backstage pass, which today would never happen. You just can't get those. So she, next day we were in class, she said, hey, I've got a backstage pass, the CMA Awards, if you want to go. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? So I took her pass, and I hurried up and I ran to Kinko's and made up some shitty little business cards. And I went and I started walking around backstage, and, you know, I'd never been to really even a major country concert. And I walked in backstage, and the first person to walk by was George Jones. The second people to walk by.
Oh my God.
The second people to walk by were Tim McGraw and Faith Hill.
Oh my God.
Wow.
And I immediately ran. There was a payphone backstage. I immediately ran to the payphone. I called my mom. I was like, "You are not going to believe this." And I started like quietly telling her like all these people I was seeing backstage. And it was like stepping into a movie. But anyway, I held my composure and was trying to be professional. And I met this guy who was a publicist for an artist named Shelley Wright. She kind of had a moment in the early 90s as well. And we just talked for a bit, and he gave me his business card. And I said, "Hey, if you don't mind, I'd love just to keep in touch and ask you a few questions. And if you need somebody to volunteer in your office, I'm happy to do that." So
it sounds very similar to a story that I'm familiar with, Daniel.
Yeah, it is familiar. And like yours, persistence eventually pays off. So I kept in contact with this guy for several months. And April of the next year, April of 98, I reached out to him. And he said, he said several other publicists and I all work together. All of them, but two of us have left to go work for a record label. He said, "Why don't you come in, next week or whatever, and we'll just talk to you." So I went in, had an interview. I wore a full suit and tie. I didn't know that in the music industry, everybody dresses down. And we had a great conversation. And then about a week later, I called to follow up, and nobody would answer. I couldn't really figure out what was going on. And I got an email or a call back, I don't remember what it was. And the lady there said, "Can you just be here tomorrow?" She said the firm, everybody who left, they had Willie Nelson and George Jones and Tammy Wynette and Randy Travis, like every major iconic artist of the 80s, this firm represented them. And they shut it down and went to work for a label. Well,
damn.
That week, two things happened. A tornado went through downtown Nashville, and Tammy Wynette died. And every news outlet in the world was calling this PR firm, which most of the publicists had left, and the phones were ringing off the hook. She said, "Everyone's calling about the Tammy Wynette funeral. We don't even represent her anymore, but our phone number is still out there. Can you just come in and help us?" So I did, sort of stepped right in the middle of Tammy Wynette's funeral going on, and because they had no help and they hadn't talked to anybody else yet. So really by default, I got this unpaid job as a part-time tour publicist assistant, whatever the hell it was called. We just sort of made it up. So, once I got past Tammy's funeral and stuff, my job really was just answering the phone, but really being a tour publicist for Waylon Jennings and Lori Morgan and Daryl Singletary and Andy Grigg.
Were you getting paid or was this like a strict internship?
No, I didn't get paid anything.
Okay, just wondering.
Which was totally illegal because I wasn't getting credit either, but I didn't tell anybody.
So how do you, just to pause right there, how did you support yourself during those times?
I don't know. I mean, I had another job in Murfreesboro, so I would I had my class schedule and I would try to go there at least a couple of days a week and then just work my ass off on nights and weekends to make it all work. And, but that's where I really learned the business. I mean, the boss, the lady that I worked for, was really hardcore. She was really tough, didn't accept anything other than excellence. And she and I are really close friends to this day. But she was the hardest person I ever worked for. But that then led to my first, I'll sort of fast forward, that led my first job in artist management through a relationship there. And really a classmate of mine at MTSU, she said, "Hey, I'm graduating and going to work full time. Do you want to come be our intern?" She said, "My roommate is in this band and they've got their first showcase coming up for Sony. And I'm going to help them." And I was like, "Cool. What's their name?" And she's like, "What's this, three girls you haven't heard of yet. Their name's the Dixie Chicks. And like I said, they're getting ready to get started on Sony." And the funny thing is when I left Missouri at the nightclub, the country club that I hung out at, the last show that I went to was by a band called the Dixie Chicks, that they called themselves a cowgirl band. So it was cool then that my, because then that internship turned into my first full-time job after I graduated.
That's a full circle moment, is what we
call it. Yeah, like them be the last band that I saw before I moved, and then the first band that I worked for straight out of college. So I did that through their tour, and then I jumped to another management company and kind of did a similar job. They were in the middle of Tim McGraw and Faith Hill's first tour. So all in 1 year, I was working on the Dixie Chicks first tour and Tim McGraw and Faith Hill's first tour, just, you know, sort of jumping right in the fire.
That is awesome. And you know, you hear all these stories about people just like grinding, right? Just grind, keep being persistent, keep calling, keep, you know, keep going for what you want.
Yeah.
And it's so exciting hearing real life stories, you know, with people that have done it, you know, like, hey, this is a tried and true method. If you want it, you got to show them that you're hungry enough to do it.
Absolutely.
And that's bad. That's badass.
That's a big part of this industry. You know, people that we've hired over the years. I mean, my top manager right now that handles Martina was an intern at MTSU. And when I first opened my company, I asked a couple professors for recommendations of somebody who was a little more mature and just seemed really aggressive and persistent. And now we hired him after his internship, and he's our top guy right now.
Who is that, Daniel?
His name's Chris Farron.
Chris, okay. I don't remember talking to him, but
did you say Cabe Wyatt?
Yes, I said Cabe Wyatt. That's right.
No, I take a little different route. I go to a class and just make like a slight connection with this dude and just kiss ass, and still waiting on my time to come. But
hey, you got to keep at it, you know.
Moral of this, that whole story, Cabe, were you listening?
Yeah, well, I heard.
You know, the one thing we
break it down.
One thing we can't plan for is a stupid pandemic to come in the middle of the plan. But you know, you just got to keep at it.
Yeah, I heard that. So Daniel, keep going with that story, because like I know, I don't want to spoil it, but I mean, you've worked with a ton of artists up until this point, and I kind of want to. You can skim through it if you like, but I mean, I want to know a little bit more of like the years that you were with like ADA, Lady A, stuff like that.
Yeah. So really, you know, coming into that company, so the company is called Borman Entertainment. I went to work there in 2000, again, during the Tim and Faith tour. And that's where I really learned tour marketing and album releases, really all from the manager perspective. And a year after I was there, we signed Keith Urban. This was really early in his career. We had the band Lone Star. So I got to really learn a little bit of what everybody in the company did. We did some work with, they were managing James Taylor out of LA at the time. We did some work on one of the Rolling Stones tour. And so I got a chance to work at a really high level, really early in my career. And after a while, I was like, you know what, this has been better experience than I ever could have dreamed for. But I really, really want to go back and start at the very bottom with a brand new act that nobody knows, nobody cares about, and build the entire career from the ground up, you know, which was a big thing to do. And just, you know, for most people only happens once in your career, if that.
So Daniel, in that, just side note, in that time period that you were, would you call it Borman?
Yeah.
Okay. In that time period, is that when you realized like, hey, like I want to be a manager, like this is what I want to do. Like what, that obviously was that time period, but what happened? Like, was there a specific moment that you remember that you said, this is what I want to do?
Not specifically. You know, I got to learn from a lot of really great people, and I just realized that if at some point I didn't take a leap to a bigger step, that, you know, you can really get stuck in an assistant level for a long time, and people start to see you as that, and you get passed over on opportunities. And I didn't want to get stuck in that perception. So the choice was either to leave and go somewhere else or try to make it happen internally. And really just by pure coincidence, an assistant at CA had reached out to our office and said, hey, we're working with this new band. They're going to do a show at Third and Lindsley. Let us know if you want to come out. So we're like, sure. So we went. And
what year was this?
This would have been the end of 2006.
Okay, cool.
And we went to Third and Lindsley, and this band named Lady Antebellum was on the stage, and there was probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 of us in the audience, maybe. Half of those were probably their family or friends. And after the show, I just walked up to Charles Kelly, the lead singer, and said, hey, I introduced myself and said, I think we're trying to set up a meeting with you guys. I really love what you're doing and I think I can help. So we had our meeting and we had another meeting, and after that they said, you know, we feel really good about this and feel like it's the right relationship for us. And I said, well, great. Then I think you should go and meet with every other manager who wants to take a meeting. And if you still feel that way after all those meetings, then call us back. And, you know, which looking back was...
That's a ballsy move, man.
Pretty stupid thing to do.
That is ballsy as shit.
Because we were taught in sales, it's like, no, close that shit right then and there. Yeah. Right? You say, yes, let's go. Here's contracts, yeah. Right?
The thing, though, in artist management is you never want somebody to have the feeling in their mind or somebody in their ear saying, well, what if, you know, what if you had gone the other way or whatever. I wanted them in that moment to be really certain, like, this is the right thing, because I don't know why. I just had this sense that if it made sense for them, we'd be able to make something really special out of it. And, you know, they didn't even have music yet, so we had very little to go on. So anyway, that all worked out, thankfully. And we jumped in head first. So we signed them in March. They signed their record deal in June. They went in the studio in July. We had a single out in September, and they were out on tour with Martina McBride in January.
All right. Just so everybody knows at home, that is fast as shit.
I don't know. I've never since then heard of any act having a trajectory that fast.
Not to say that I would know like what fast is, but in less than a year, if you're a supporting act on a tour with Martina effing McBride, like, that's really, 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 really fast.
Yeah. Well, I'm one of those people that I'm not aware, right? And I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know either. How long would a process like that
I mean, some people...
Luke Bryan took years. Luke Bryan was signed to Capitol, or was it Capitol?
Yeah.
Okay, he was signed to Capitol under Mike Dungan, I'm pretty sure, for at least 2 years. Before probably. And now he's as big as he could possibly be.
Yeah. I mean, some people it takes 10 years. I mean, it's pretty rare that it happens in less than like 3 years. The closest thing that I've seen to it in my career would be Luke Combs.
Which, speaking of, Daniel, I was going to bring up later. So don't let me forget to bring that up if we still have time. But
yeah. So just kind of finish that story. So yeah, so we signed them and it went quickly, as we just talked about. And then, you know, I spent the next almost 7 years in that role. And, you know, in that time, they had a bunch of number one songs. They sold a lot of albums. And
when did Need You Now come out?
Need You Now came out in September or October of 2009 or 2010. I forget.
I want to say it was 09. I think it was 09. I don't know.
I think it was 2010 because I was still in high school when it came.
Well, so that's my point with that, Lakota, is the, like, you don't listen to country music and you know what I'm talking about. That song was a fucking monster.
Yeah.
Like, international. Well, so what was that like for you, Daniel, like on the backside of it? Like, what's the process like to have a song that crosses over, which is extremely hard to do in country, like from country to pop and stuff? What was that like?
Well, if you look at a country radio chart now, most artists take at least 30 weeks, some of them 50 or 60 weeks to get to number one, if they get that far. With Need You Now, we were number one in 13 weeks. And
that's insane.
And immediately it went over to pop radio, which none of us really thought that made sense as a crossover song. It originally was not even going to be on the album. It was the very last song they recorded for that album. And none of us had it planned as the first single or a single at all. And then when it took off so fast at country, we just asked the pop team at Capitol Records, like, will you just listen to this and feel like if it has any chance of maybe going to like adult contemporary or something. And the research just came back so strong. They went ahead and sent it out. The pop radio ended up being a number two song at top 40 and then being a number one song in 13 countries.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That is insane. 13 weeks to number one.
I mean, Taylor Swift hasn't even done that. You know?
Yeah, that's insane, dude. That's crazy.
So that kind of set us off on a path that just, you know, and the week that album came out, it was the end of January.
That was the lead single, right?
Yeah. And I think the album came out, I don't know, second week of January or something. I forget what it was. Anyway, the album release and the Grammy Awards just happened to be really close, and they got a Grammy Awards performance.
And holy shit.
So we did the Ellen DeGeneres show and the Grammy Awards kind of in the same week, I believe. And
rest in peace, Ellen.
Yeah. I think we were projected to sell about 120,000 albums that week, which was a really big number. The first album had sold 43,000 in the first week. And we ended up selling 481,000 albums that week.
Holy shit, dude. That is a lot.
I mean, literally.
Yeah, oh my God.
We were getting calls from the label every few hours like, we've got to send out 10,000 more albums and 10,000 more albums. Like, they were literally packaging boxes of CDs as fast as they could and overnighting them to retail stores. I mean, it's just doesn't happen.
That is unreal.
Yeah. So, you know, I spent the next 6 years in that role, and it just, you know, it kept sort of going and going. And I finally had reached a point. I was like, you know, I love this job and I love the band that I'm with. But again, if I don't sort of like start over from the beginning again and build it all up, I'm never going to have a chance to do that. So,
you also get comfortable too and complacent. And you're just like, cool, I'm just going to ride this wave.
You do.
Instead of building something even bigger.
Yeah. So I quit my job kind of in the height of my artist career that I worked with. And, you know, they weren't signed to me. They were signed to the company that I worked for. And I didn't ask them to come with me. I just said, it's time for me to step out and create my own company and my own roster. And in the back of my mind, I always said, if for some chance down the road later in life, they ever decide to make a change, I'll always be there for them. But again, ethically, it didn't make sense to like offer that to them. So I left, took my life savings, and I started my own company. I hired some people that I felt like could help get it off the ground. And we started signing a couple of acts, and, we got it off the ground. And then about 5 months into it, Corin Capshaw, who owns Red Light Management, called me and said, hey, the band is making a change. And just because you have all this institutional knowledge of their career, we'd love for you to find a way to reengage. I know you have your new company and you're trying to get off the ground and all that, but if you could figure it out, it'd be great. And at first I said no. And then because I felt like it would feel like I tried to steal them from where they were, even though that wasn't the case. I didn't want that optic. But then I reconsidered and said, you know, I had always said in my mind that if the chance came to work with them again, that I would say yes. So I did. So I re-engaged with them and we partnered with Red Light. And, you know, at the time, I don't know what their roster size was, but now there's probably 400 artists around the world and 200 and some managers. So we just carved out our own little niche within this really monstrosity of a company and just sort of set my little new company within it and let it sort of be an incubator for us. And that's where we are now. So, you know, the Lady A thing ran its course after about 4 years. But during that time, we signed Martine McBride and we signed Cassidy Pope and I've signed Raleigh Green and Lane Hardy. So, you know, it didn't all happen in the sequence and the time that I thought it would, but it happened in the way that it should have.
That is badass. So how long ago was it that you started your own management firm?
That was 7 years ago. It'll be 7 years on October 1st from when we opened.
Okay. So it took about 4 years working with Lady A to kind of like start signing a bigger roster. Was I hearing that correctly?
I mean, we were signing acts between them. So like about 2 years into it's when we signed Martina.
Okay.
And we're signing things along the way. So yeah, the two things are really happening side by side.
That is so cool. I don't know, but I'm sure Cabe is like geeking out about all this, but it's cool for me to listen to this because I know nothing about the music industry. And Cabe's right. I don't really listen to country music. I like country music, but I don't listen to it on a daily.
Yeah. You know, they always say that the failure rate in the music business is about 95%. You know, so many more artists and people in the industry fail than those succeed. So, you know, I don't know what to attribute that to, but thankfully it's worked out so far.
I think that's in the entertainment business alone, isn't probably. It? I mean,
yeah,
you know, most people fail at acting. Most people fail at, podcasting, right? Most people fail in music. It's that small percentage of people that are household names.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I think that's how it should be. Daniel, and you've carved your way into that.
Daniel, I would ask you like what you thought was like, I would ask you what you would say the trait is for making it work out. But I mean, I know what you're going to say. You're just going to say hard work. And, well,
you know, a little bit of it's being naive too, you know, like along the way, I didn't know what was okay and wasn't okay. I just sort of had my goals and my eyes set on certain things and was just like, I'm going to figure this out, you know, and you just figure it out.
Yeah. So with you, you mentioned your four artists that you guys are actively working with now, Lane Hardy, Cassidy Pope, Martina McBride, and Riley Green. You said there's been two albums already dropped. I could tell you what those two are. What are the next two this year, like within the year 2020?
Gosh. Go ahead.
No, you talk about it. I just wanted to give you a chance to plug, basically.
Yeah. So we started the year before COVID. Martina was invited to go on the show Songland. The booker was just a friend of mine, and she reached out and said the producers would love to have her on.
That was a great episode, by the way. I watched three of those episodes like back to back to back just to like compare her episode. It's pretty awesome. And the song was great too. But
and I hadn't really watched the show, so I didn't know a whole lot about it. I knew the concept.
Dude, the show, I mean, I know it's TV and it's LA and like all that shit, but like the show is pretty, it's a pretty cool concept for a TV show.
Yeah.
What is it?
So it's called Song. Yeah, you describe it, Daniel.
It's called Songland. It's the same producers that created The Voice and that executive producers for The Voice. And
okay.
It's like Shark Tank, except for songwriters. So they have a panel of judges. The only thing different is they bring in an artist, and the judges and the artist evaluate.
The judges are songwriters too, like very successful.
Okay. Legendary. Yeah. And these four songwriters get to come in the room and pitch about 30 seconds of a song they've written. And at the end of the episode, the artist chooses one of them to record and release. So that's what happened. And so we chose the song and came back to Nashville, and then COVID happened and the episode had been taped and it had to air. So we had to figure out how to record the song and film a music video at the beginning of quarantine when there were no rules yet. And because it was part of the commitment. So anyway, we pulled that off. And then, you know, we quickly learned how to record and release music in quarantine. So Riley Green was asked to do a show for SiriusXM. They're a big sponsor and always on site for Stagecoach, which happens after Coachella. So since Stagecoach didn't happen, they asked all the artists to come back and do acoustic performances for a program they called Stage Couch, From Your Couch. And those five songs that Riley did turned out so well, we made an album out of it. So we put the album out and turned that around really quickly. And then, you know, Cassidy had plans to go into the studio that spring and do her next record, and this all happened and she couldn't. And we said, well, look, let's figure out how to pivot. What can you do and what do you feel called to do? And she said, you know, I think there are some songs that I have written that they never found their place on an album that I'd like to see if I could do acoustic versions of them and put them together in an album. And it actually came together brilliantly and has kind of changed the course of her career. So that was the next album that we did. And then Lane Hardy, who came off of American Idol, we'd put out a song or two, but had to keep doing more. So we just kept cranking out songs of his. And since then, Riley Green has recorded the first half of his next album, and it comes out on September 11th. And we've got an amazing concept for Cassidy in the works that'll hopefully come out first quarter next year. And Lane Hardy will have an album first quarter next year. So like Cassidy, we just kept rocking.
With Cassidy's, like, and you're talking about how this out, like it did, I mean, it did pretty well for her, right? Like it sounds pretty positive. Did that progress into any type of traction with a record label, or like, is this project that she's going to be working on? Like, is the next thing going to be another independent or what? Or do you guys even know yet?
We don't know. You know, I always feel like, you know, we make really detailed strategic plans and we execute on them, but they have to always be fluid because everything changes. No matter how good your plan is, it always changes. So we always leave a little bit of room just for life to present opportunities in front of you. And we always say, let's keep our eyes open for, you know, things along the path as you're walking down it to figure it out. So with her, when I started working with Cassidy, she had just come off of Big Machine, the label group for Big Machine, and she was able to terminate all of her deals that came from the show. So her record label, her publishing, her attorney, everything in her career, she terminated all at once. And that's when I met with her and I said, look, let's put it all back together. We'll assemble a new team around you. And she had started recording an album and we had her finish that. And I said, let's not worry about a record label. You make the record you want to make. We'll figure out how to pay for it. We'll release it on our own and we'll just see where it goes. And we did that. And it was the first time in her life she ever received any record royalties. And the year following was the highest grossing year she'd ever had in her career. So I think, you know, it was really an unconventional path, but that album and the acoustic album that came after that and the next one that's to come has been a really thoughtful evolution and progression that I'm really excited for people once it happens early next year to see where it kind of landed.
That's awesome. That's sick. I mean, it just sounds like from what you're saying, it just sounds like the authenticity that's coming from her overall is very apparent. And I think that's great in country music because from my perspective, it seems like people can smell that shit. Yeah. Like it's not, I mean, I don't know. I couldn't really give an example of a bad authentic song, but if it is authentic, people will gravitate to it. So,
you know, we're not in a corporate office and we don't operate with a corporate mentality. I don't have contracts with any of my artists or anybody on the team. You know, we operate as a family. Our office is in a shitty old house on Music Row and it's set up like a home.
Dope house. It is a dope house. It is not shitty.
Music Row. What's Music Row? Oh, so you got to explain that to me.
Yeah. So you've probably heard the old song, the lyrics say, you know, here's to the boys that make the noise on 16th Avenue. So
yes,
16th Avenue, 16th and 17th Avenue in Nashville back in probably the 60s is just where, you know, the early producers and songwriters and labels, they just happened to all kind of land there. And, you know, since they didn't really have the money to go into large corporate offices, they just started taking over these old bungalow homes that were on those two streets. And over the last 50 years, it has just always been known as Music Row. So most of the record labels, most of the managers, publishers, attorneys, and all the organizations in the country music industry kind of live within these two or three blocks in that part of Nashville. It's changed a little bit, but anyway, so our office is on 16th Avenue. And it's this old house from the 1920s. It's been a million things over the years. And we operate in there, but we set it up like a home because we want our artists to be able to feel comfortable to come in and be happy, be sad, be mad, whatever it is, in a really private space that, you know, we plan and we address problems and life and career and whatever. You know, I've had them come in there and cry. I've had them come in there and scream. I've had them come in there and be really happy and toast, cheers, you know. But our artists and our team all operate as a family. You know, our number one trait, I think, is just compassion. You know, we treat people as people. And in that process with our artists, we always sit them down and, you know, it's almost like a psychoanalyst session. We really want to know exactly who they are, what their psychological makeup is, what's all the bullshit and baggage they have in their life, because that affects everything. And based on that, we help them. We don't create a path for them. We help them find their own path and give them all the tools and bring in all the people that we need to, you know, guide them toward that.
That's sick.
So, Daniel, from where you're at right now, where do you see like your artists and your firm here in like the next several years? Right? Like, what do you have like a goal? Because I know you say you don't set up like a corporate structure, but you are still a business.
Yeah.
How, where do you see the growth?
Yeah. In the next years? We do put together pretty detailed annual financial projections. I mean, we've got a fiduciary responsibility to all of our clients to make sure that they earn the living that they want. And
I learned that term today in a class, actually, Daniel. So shout out to you for that, fiduciary.
And same to my team, you know, they all depend on me for their living as well. So our annual plan is both financial and strategic in terms of music and touring. And, you know, we try to put growth markers on each of their careers, whether it's 20% or 30% or whatever it is. And, you know, we can only plan so far. But, you know, I think for us, you know, Riley Green is headed toward being a major headline artist in country music.
Give him a shout out for his award that he just won, Daniel.
Yeah, he did. He just won the ACM New Male Artist of the Year, which is a major upset because on paper, most people would think Morgan Wallen would have won that award.
Yeah, I love Riley, but I definitely would have guessed Morgan would have won that award.
Yeah. But you know, to your question, we do short-term and long-term planning and forecasting. And then a year like this comes along and sort of blows it all to hell. But, you know, we still keep moving forward toward that. So to really answer your question, we just have strategic plans in place for each of our artists. And we only have the capacity to take on so many. I'm never going to be a company where we have 20 or 30 artists we're managing. It's always going to be 4 to 7, probably at most. So that's kind of where we are.
I feel like that's such a smart strategy to have, especially like what I've heard from you so far. You really like to be hands-on and personal and provide a not just like a great experience for these artists that you help, but a real personal connection with them.
Yeah. And you know, it's a really intimate relationship in a lot of ways. And strategically, we always say that, you know, some companies go an inch deep and a mile wide, and we go a mile deep and an inch wide. It's just a lot more about really digging into who they are as a person and who they are as a brand and how we set them up to be a 20, 30, 50-year-old, you know, 50-year-long career.
That is bizarre. I've never even thought about, like, musicians having 50-year careers, but they do.
Pretty rare.
They really know forever.
You know, the bell curve usually for most artists, you know, 5 to 7 years is kind of the lifespan. So, you know, to plan beyond that is tough. But, you know, Martina's going into her 30th year. And we're hoping that everybody else can follow the same path.
That's awesome.
So, Daniel, just referring back to something you said in the last 5 minutes, I texted you saying I was going to ask about it, but we brought it up today in one of my classes. And I made sure to ask her because I remember this being one of the first things that you said to me in our class that I took in the spring. You said that you never sign your artists to a contract or your acts, whatever you want to call it. You never sign them to a contract, and you've answered this to me before, but I kind of want this to be out there in the air just because I think it's an interesting thing to be, I don't know, it seems rare, and she made it very, very clear that it was a very rare thing, but I also don't trust her, I trust you, so.
Well, yeah, that stood out to me too, because it's, you know, it really does put it up in the air, and I feel like it forces you to like really work harder for these artists, which I'm assuming.
Yeah. I mean, my philosophy to that is that, I mean, where I came from and how I was raised, when I look somebody in the eye and shake their hand, I mean that, whatever it is. And so we commit to a certain level of what we're going to provide and deliver to them. And if we fail on that, shame on us. And I don't feel like somebody should be held to a period of time if we're not living up to our expectations. So it holds me accountable and our team accountable, but it also gives the artist a sense of like, okay, this team is really invested in me and my career, and it's a lot more than just a piece of paper. But, you know, my attorney would tell you it's the dumbest thing I've ever done.
Of course, because they're looking at it.
Every couple of years, it's like, you know, you should have contracts with people, right? I'm like, I know, but I'm not going to.
No, but I think that's such a smarter play because there are, I can only imagine there's thousands, tens, twenties of thousands of artists that were failed by their label or their manager and then still had to stick around and pump out music out of contractual obligation. And that's, it doesn't help the fans because the fans don't want that. They don't want force-fed songs. And then the artist also isn't thriving. They're not happy.
Well,
so they don't even want to perform.
And almost everybody that we work with and everybody we've done well with was in a prior management relationship before they came to us. So for whatever reason, that relationship didn't work or it was broken. So in those scenarios in particular, I just, it feels weird to me to have them sign a piece of paper when they don't know that we're going to do any better than where they were before. So I feel like it's on us then to prove that.
In a way,
fair point.
In a way, it's like the complete opposite of what you would expect. Like as an artist walking into a meeting, say you have meeting one, meeting two, meeting three, and you're like, all right, I'm going with Daniel. And then they walk into this meeting where they expect to sign a contract.
Yeah.
And you're just like, no. And then you say all of that, like that, to me, that would win an artist over like that, like so fast that it just seems, I don't know, that just seems like a super authentic way to run things. And I think it's dope.
Every time I've ever gone into a meeting where I really, really wanted that act, it's worked. So hopefully so.
Yeah, I don't think Ari Gold did that in Entourage. So that I'm learning something new about the talent management.
Yeah, I'm not that ruthless. But
No, absolutely not. And when Cabe was like, man, we have to have this guy on. He's awesome. He has a lot of insight in the industry.
I'm also still trying to kiss his ass, but...
Yeah, but I mean, Daniel, you have proven that. I mean, it's not like you had anything to prove to me. I'm nobody. So that is what it is. But... I had no idea what to expect.
Yeah.
And so the only thing I had to go off of is what, you know, pop culture has taught me. And specifically, that's why I mentioned Ari Gold.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, this is going to be like some fast talking, ruthless person, yada, yada. I want to hear this. This was much better than I was expecting. So thank you for like blowing my expectations out of the way. I really appreciate that.
I've really only been at this, you know, professionally for 20 years. I mean, 20 years in...
quit being humble, Dave.
Yeah, only
being humble. Years. Okay. Get out of here.
I want to be able to do this for 20 or 30 more years. So I've still got, in my mind, a lot to prove still.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, same with this podcast. I mean, I've only been doing this. I think Cabe, we don't have a contract, but Cabe was brought on as my co-host 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, like not long ago.
3 weeks ago, but I'd been doing it solo with like, you know, featured guests and stuff like that. Cabe's been on countless times since last December. So almost a year now.
It's awesome. Good for you.
Yeah. And thank you. And I mean, it's a lot of fun. I mean, there's no expectations out of this either. It's just fun to like really learn about either different industries or different people's lives and hear like badass stories or hear some motivational stories. Hearing your story gives me a lot of insight on what we could do with the podcast, Cabe and I, as we move forward together and, you know, continue to be authentic like we have been.
Yeah.
So
that's all you can do, right? I mean, people can sniff through bullshit pretty easily these days. So, you know, the only person you know how to be is yourself. So
that's true. That's true.
Daniel, I have one last question, and I've been wanting to ask you this for a hot little minute. I just never really took the time. So I want you to just think of on the top of your head, the biggest five artists of your life, artists/bands, like they were the most influential to your life. And like, maybe it's the band that you were reading the back of their CD in your apartment in Missouri, calling their management company. Like who are the most influential five? You can give me a little more, a little less if that's what it is, but. I just want to know who influenced you the most and still does. It could be somebody now, but it can't be Riley Green, Martina McBride, Lane Hardy, or Cassie Pope.
Yeah. You know, number one would be the band Alabama. Just because that, you know, when I was a kid in the early 80s, they were the hottest thing in music. And in my family and people I grew up around, that's it really connected. So, you know, musically, what I started listening to, you know, we grew up with my step grandfather as kids. And, you know, this is so, God, it's so cliche to say this, but it's true. You know, he literally played Johnny Cash records at night and he played Glen Campbell records at night. And those were the only two albums in our house that we owned. And so that's sort of what started it. And then, you know, as I formed my own taste, it'd be Alabama, Kenny Rogers, George Strait, you know, those artists from the early 80s. But, you know, when I was in high school, like, I mean, I'm not really answering your question, but kind of.
No, this is what I wanted.
You know, my friends and I, we listened to NWA and Eazy-E and stuff like that.
Hell yeah.
That's up my alley. Yeah. Okay, now we're talking my language.
Was, okay. you know, a lot. And Michael Jackson. I put Michael Jackson in that in that list as well. Oh, and, yeah. You know, but then later in life, it I mean, gosh, it's changed so many people for different reasons, you know. Just but now, fortunately and unfortunately, I look at people for influence based on how they run their business more than their music a little bit. Although I'm still fans of a lot of people, but you know, the people I really look up to now are the ones that can put on an unbelievable, undeniable live experience that just sort of.
Have you ever heard of a band called Vinewood?
I have. Very, okay. A lot. I think they're next on the list.
Yeah, let's hope.
But yeah, you know, to answer your question, everybody from Alabama, Kenny Rogers, Michael Jackson to, you know, people that I still admire today.
Yeah. What is one of the bands that you set, like when you say you're looking at the back, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm not too young to know what it's like to look at a CD. Cause I used to do that, read the lyrics and not know what any of it meant, like any of the thank yous or the record label on the back. I didn't understand any of that, but like when you look at the back of a CD, what was one of those bands in your apartment before you moved down here that you called their management company or whatever?
Yeah. So there's a guy, Brian White, who was pretty popular in the mid 90s. His was the first one that had a phone number, and I called his management company and talked to somebody there.
It had that on the CD.
Yeah. Yeah. Dang, surprising. That's crazy. I don't know why, but they did.
Yeah.
And I wish I knew who it was that answered the phone. That company doesn't exist anymore, but I wish I knew who that was, but I have no idea even what his name was.
Yeah.
That's so bizarre.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, if you were to put out a record today and like there would be I feel like, I don't know, I'm assuming, but if Riley were to put out a physical CD, which I'm sure you guys still do, but if it had your phone number on the back, like,
Nonstop blown up.
You put some shit in your inbox, dude.
It's just, I mean, the access is just different. I don't know why they put their phone numbers on there back then, you know. But I will say, to this day, having liner notes in an album, whether digitally or physically, is still really important to me because I do like reading. I mean, the reason I read them so much then was I wanted to know who the songwriters were, and I became familiar with who the producers were. And
I'm the same way. I've definitely. Lately, I mean, like since I decided that I wanted to do music when I was like 17, like do the music business, I've definitely learned to appreciate who the producer is, who the songwriters are, like who the people are behind the scenes, because it's not just like this, or it's not just somebody putting out a song and like it just completely blowing up. Like yeah. There's a record
and everything like who the photographer was and just, you know, everything involved with it. So, you know, with digital albums and streaming music, it's a lot harder to find those credits. So, you know, we try to like either make them social post or available on the band's website or somewhere so people can still find them.
Yeah.
And I'm not that hard to find, actually. You can track me down.
No, you cannot.
Well,
there's like three things of you on the internet. Like I sent him everything I could find about you and it was three things.
Well, I know for our listeners, there will be a link to your firm's website and then any socials that you want to share, whether it be yours or you and your artists. Yeah. down in the description. So I'll definitely leave that on there for anybody who just wants to click and familiarize yourself with their with his artists and with Daniel Miller. Well, so
thank you.
Absolutely. I'm like a loss for words. I think I got all my questions answered.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm satisfied.
Daniel knows this is not going to be the last time I ask him a question. I'll probably think of something tomorrow at like 6 a.m.
Well, you know where to find me.
Yeah.
Well, to wrap this up, you know, Daniel, thank you so much for coming on. I know I've thanked you profusely already, but I want to know how you guys actually met. I'm assuming it was at school.
Daniel, yeah. I want to hear you say this. I want your side of the story because my side of the story is a whole lot of kissing ass. Give me the tea. Let's hear it.
You know, so the music business program at MTSU was really and is really important to me because it allowed me to start my career and meet people and learn about, you know, what would become my life eventually. So I've stayed really involved over the years and would come back and speak to classes almost every semester. And they were really kind enough to give me an award 4 or 5 years ago. And I was at lunch with two of the professors in the department a couple of years ago. And they just said, we don't feel like our students really understand what artist management is. You know, we either have an attorney teach it or somebody just on faculty, but we never have a manager.
Somebody taking right now that does not know a damn thing about the music industry. Cough, cough, not going to name any names. Daniel, yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I said, look, our role is the only one in the artist career that is a full 360 perspective of what's happening because we deal with every person in the artist career every day. And that's sort of unique and it's really hard to teach that to somebody. So they said, would you mind putting together just a syllabus? If you were to teach this class, what would it look like? And I said, sure. And there's some things that I feel like students should know that when we hire interns, they don't know. So I put together a syllabus for them and I sent it to them and they were like, holy shit, that would you come teach this? I was like, I don't know. Like that was always sort of like my retirement gig idea. Like I'll, you know, when I retire, I'll teach college until I'm dead or whatever. And I thought about it for a while. I was like, you know, this is the best way that I can give back to an organization that has done a lot for me. And, you know, we do a lot of continuing education on my team. So I'm really all about people staying current. So Cabe was in my third semester that I taught. And to be honest, you can look out at a class really in the first 10 minutes and you can look at people's, just their expressions and can tell whether they really care about what you're talking about or not. And
true.
Cabe was one of the few that was sort of like hanging on every word, but immediately had really smart, insightful questions. And I'm like, I can tell this kid cares. He really cares about
been smart or insightful, but immediately, literally after everything he said, like I might not have said it out loud, but there was something that I was like, all right, question.
Yeah. Every semester there's been one or two, you know, a small handful of students. You can tell like, okay, they really are on a path and this is really important to them and they don't have a plan B, you know, and that's the whole thing in this business is you cannot have a plan B. You're going to make it work, whatever it takes. And, you know, it's pretty easy to spot those people and you learn to respect them really quickly. And, you know, Cabe was one of those.
That is awesome. And he's just to bring it up. Cabe still has immediate questions. I don't think he's let you finish one sentence before he's like, oh,
no, dude, you should.
I got something.
But I have questions too. You know, we still learn every day and my team, we meet every single day and we ask each other questions. And especially as, you know, as I get older and bring on younger people, they have different perspectives of doing things and there's always new technology and people are always consuming music differently. So I feel like I ask as many questions as I answer.
Oh yeah, you definitely have to. I mean, just look at in the past 20 years since you started in the industry, how much it's changed now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I people who are born in 2020 will not know what a CD is.
No, not at all.
They won't. They won't know what a CD is. I mean, they won't even know what Bluetooth is because everything's going to be in their head. It's going to be a chip in their head and they're just going to be listening to music that way.
Dear God.
Right.
And again, you know, that's as you get older, 20 years becomes a pretty short period of time. But, you know, when I started, like I said, there was no internet or not widely used anyway. There were no cell phones or not widely used. There was no texting. There were no streaming. We sold CDs and listened. There was no Sirius XM radio. None of that existed when I started. So it's made a dramatic change in the last 20 years.
That's crazy. That's so bizarre.
I want to tell Lakota about this just really quick. So Lakota, like week probably six or seven, I think it was probably week seven of like our class. I just asked Daniel, it was the week before spring break. So the week before this, the week that I'm about to talk about is the week that shit hit the fan. Like everything went downhill very, very, very quickly. Like we were talking about earlier, but I was like, Daniel, like, what are you doing over spring break? He was like, well, Riley's got a show on Monday at the Floribama. Lane's got this in Baton Rouge, or I'm going to be in Australia with Cassidy. And I was like, oh, shit.
Sure. Well, I forgot about that.
Yeah. I remember specifically, Daniel. And he was like, but like, I'll probably end up at the Riley show. And I was like, oh, shit. You like, are you going to hook me up with some tickets? And he was like, yeah. Yeah. So me and my friends like road tripped down for this show that was at like 4 p.m. We left at 5 a.m. that morning, get down there. By the time we got to the show, I was probably seven deep, like not sober. Walk in, Daniel gives us the tickets outside. We walk in and then Daniel's at the front of house watching the show. I'm like going to buy Bushwhackers every 15 or 20 minutes. But in between that, I swear to God, like if I wasn't drunk, it probably would have happened anyways. But I was talking Daniel's ear off the entire damn time. And I just want to give Daniel like a shout out for that, because I mean, I probably would have learned all this stuff eventually. But it's pretty cool to have somebody that's as involved in the industry as you, Daniel, who actually takes the time to listen to me and hear the questions that I have and answer them accurately. One, because you know what you're talking about, and two, you're a genuine dude. So I just want to give you a shout out and a thank you for that.
Well, thank you. But it's also like, you know, this is my life, not my career. You know, this industry, when you sign up for it, it's a lifestyle, not a job. You know, it's you're always on the clock, and you know, we miss a lot of vacations and holidays and all that, but that's what we choose, you know? So anybody in my personal life will tell you, like, my career, for better or for worse, has always come first. You know, it's just, this is my life. It's what I wanted to do. So that's why I do it.
I love that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I think we should wrap this up.
Yeah, I think
that's absolutely. Thank you again for coming on. I mean, I honestly had no idea what to expect, and I enjoyed this a lot, and I hope you did too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully this scored some brownie points for Cabe.
Yeah.
Wink, wink.
I also enjoyed this very much. Daniel, give me a job or a job or anything.
Daniel, I just want to say for the listeners, that's how Cabe became the co-host.
Not true.
No, it's not. I mean, kind of. I mean, you did ask. Like, you brought it up. I think the first time in Salt Lake City, where you're like, oh, you're making a podcast, right? Because you were there. You're there after my second episode.
You had done like two episodes. And I was like,
I've done two episodes. You're like, man, that would be so cool. And I'm like, yeah. Like, I barely know this guy. And I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. You're a cool guy.
We're best friends. Get out of here.
Bro, I met you like 3 weeks prior or month prior.
And a half months. We're best friends. Shut up.
Yeah, I mean, now we are, but yeah, it's Cabe's a unique person who's definitely going to go far.
Yeah, well,
so
I'm honored you all asked me to join, so thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, Daniel, go ahead and shout out like your socials, not your social security number, but your socials on Instagram and Twitter or whatever you use. And then also, I'll link everybody else in, but if you want to shout out your artists as well, we'll definitely link them in the description.
I think that our artists are easy to find. So Mark Tim McBride, Riley Green, Lane Hardy, and Cassidy Pope. But all of our company stuff would be at Fusion Music MGMT.
All of our artists would be easy to find because they're all effing massive. Thank you all. Mic drop.
They're all busy. I'll give them that. And they're all great people.
Well, they have one new fan because I'm going to check them out. Yeah. I know. Who was I on? We'll end this soon. But who was I listening to? And I really like this. Oh, Riley Green. There was this girl.
Yeah.
Damn. That song, I really like that song. That was good.
Is the jam. But also, Daniel, really quick, today me and Dakota were like prepping for like 10 minutes. And I was like telling him like about the artist and yada yada. And I was like, oh, well, he has Martina McBride. You know who that is, right? And he was like, no. So that's how out of the country music world Dakota is. So if he actually likes it.
Always looking for new converts.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and I've always listened to country music growing up. I mean, Tim McGraw has been my favorite, but that's like, you know, anyone who doesn't listen to country music would probably say George Strait or, you know, Keith Urban or Tim McGraw and stuff like that. And those are big names, but, you know, the newer music that's coming out is really, really good.
People like Riley and just the give him the shout out he deserves. People like Riley, Luke Combs, like a lot of the Morgan Wallen stuff. Like it's all very Cody Johnson. Like it's very not the type of country that was the bro country of the 2010s. Like it's very not traditional, but it's like a new take on the old ways. And I think that's why people are starting to gravitate towards that a lot.
Yeah. Well, awesome, Daniel. I want to have you on again when everything ends and kind of like recap here in the next several months.
Yeah, it'd be great.
On like how you guys adapted further because, you know, we could be dealing with this pandemic for, you know, another 6 months or so.
Dear God, please.
I know. Well, I know.
I think we'll deal with some version of it for a long time, you know, for years.
Oh, without a doubt.
We just got to figure out how to live with it.
It's true. Awesome. Well, we'll let you go. We know you're a busy man.
Thank you, Ryan. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Daniel. All
right. Thank you.
See ya.
All right, Contians, that's all we got for you. I hope you all enjoyed this episode. We really enjoyed hearing Daniel's insight in the industry. Be sure to subscribe and rate us wherever you found this and turn on notifications so that you never miss a new episode each week. This episode was brought to you by PhilosApothecary.com. I've been using CBD oil for about 2 years now, and I recently switched to a pure CBD instead of full spectrum. And I can't rant and rave about this enough. It's the reason why I started my own retailer and hopefully launching my own line of CBD is because I believe in its ability to help those that are dealing with anxiety, depression, stress, soreness, anything. It definitely helps with any inflammation in the body. So if you're wanting to try it out, go ahead and visit philosapothecary.com. Use promo code ICONTEVEN, all one word, at checkout to receive 15% off and free shipping, only on US orders. So I apologize for all my international listeners. All of our socials are going to be linked down in the description, and so is Daniel Miller's and Fusion Music Management and all of his artists that he currently manages. Now, many of you are probably already following them, but be sure to check them out on Spotify or Apple, and check them out on Instagram and show them some love. These are really talented artists, and some of them are just legends. We will talk with y'all next week, and I hope you guys have a great rest of this week. Peace.